Chapter 14, Burning to Ash. After returning from the second trip, I decided that it wasn't important to live close to Baba physically, but psychologically and spiritually, to have him always in my mind and heart. I began to study his teachings more diligently and to make serious attempts to put them into action in my life. I began to discipline myself in yoga and meditation, initially for short, intermittent periods, and then regularly twice a day, morning and evening. The more I engaged in this practice, the more I enjoyed it. Without effort, I found myself increasing the amount of time devoted to it. Also, I began attending bhajan groups and then developed a study group myself, so several nights a week, I was meeting with other Baba devotees to study and participate in devotional services. I was fascinated in observing what began to happen. My emotional and mental responses began to change in a way that had not been the case after a number of years in psychotherapy. Like strong, steady winds blowing away an obscuring cloud cover, my spiritual practices began to reveal an inner dimension I had never glimpsed before. I had heard of others experiencing such things as light, expansion, timelessness, and boundless love. But I had thought such feelings imaginary or illusory. Now I began to wonder about this vast, uncharted part of myself. Just as orgasm provides physical and emotional release after one has reached a certain level of sexual maturity, could it be that inherent in this inner dimension are mechanisms which, when discovered and unlocked, can release us into higher levels of consciousness? I make it a point when teaching students in psychiatry to ask whether any of them spends time in meditation. Virtually no psychiatrist or resident I've ever asked meditates regularly. Only one or two have ever engaged in the practice at all. Many are completely unfamiliar with the process. This, in a group of people whose concern is the healing of mental and emotional problems and who are supposedly dealing with inner space. What then is meditation like? Although there are many different techniques of meditation, one generally enters a state in which he ceases to be bothered by background sounds, thought fragments, fantasies, and emotions. In this stillness, we may experience the eternal. Baba says, quote, "Take the screen in the cinema theater. When the film is on, you do not see the screen, you see only the play. When the show is over, you see just a screen that has no message, neither voice, nor name, nor form, nor color, nor creed. That is Brahman. The rope gives the appearance of a snake in the dark. Here, the entire screen was lost in the picture." End quote. What are some of the experiences which might follow? Baba says, first, you are in the light. Next, the light is in you. And finally, the light and you are one. End quote. He teaches that one may begin to experience the light of divine energy first as something separate and outside oneself, then as penetrating and permeating one, and even though separate, as originating inside oneself. The ultimate state, the light and you are one, experiencing oneself as light, reflects the condition of going beyond duality, merging with the Atma or universal self the God within. As I began to experience the excitement and exhilaration of discovery and meditation, and began to see in Baba a great scientist and teacher of consciousness, I again developed a yearning to be with him. I wanted to question him specifically about the various steps in meditation and to follow his directions exactly in extending myself into this dimension of consciousness which was opening up before me. Also, having been away from Baba for 6 months, the thought of seeing him and experiencing his bliss at first hand again was very tempting. Well, Indra Devi was going to be making the trip soon, and after only a minimal amount of time spent considering alternatives, I decided to join her. Off I went for the third time to India. This time, I was an old hand at travel. My journey was pleasant, and I welcomed the opportunity to be by myself and meditate for long periods, sitting quietly and immersing myself in the experience of Baba. After the long trip, we landed in Bombay, where the sights were now familiar and extremely enjoyable, the experience really psychedelic, the smells, images, movement, getting lost in all this marvelous activity. I was growing to love the India that I knew. Arriving in Bangalore late that night, we found that Baba was in Vrindavan, his summer residence. Early the next morning, I was sitting by the side of a walkway with 30 other Americans and hundreds of Indians waiting for him to come out of the house. Next to me was a traveling companion, a young painter from Santa Barbara. As I saw the orange robe appear, my heart quickened, and there returned all the familiar and longed-for love and excitement. Baba floated blissfully down the walk from the house, looking heavenly and beautiful. It was a miracle to experience myself beginning to vibrate and be aware of so much warmth inside. We were sitting to Baba's right. About 10 feet away, he turned to a group of people sitting on the other side of the walk and rotated his hand with all the serene majesty I remembered. Suddenly, in the hand, his sleeve rolled up, was the sacred ash, Vibhuti. Steve, the painter, moved closer to me and said in a hushed voice, "That was worth the whole trip." He was silent for a moment. Then he continued, in almost a whisper, "I can feel karma from many years being lifted from my shoulders. I'm free. I'm soaring." Baba strolled amongst us, greeting us with loving smiles for 15 or 20 minutes, then began to walk back to the house. All of a sudden, he looked my way and walked over to me. "How is your brother?" he asked. I recalled with sudden vividness Donald's asking me just before my departure whether I thought Baba would remember him. I had replied, "Sure, he remembers everyone." Baba's question would be a great gift to bring back to Don, and my smile broadened and my heart went out to him. "He is very well, Baba," I said, the tone of my voice full of the big grin I could feel on my face. "Good, good," he said in English, smiling back. Then he turned and headed toward the house. Indra Devi came up to the group and said that Baba was going to invite us in and that we should wait. Later that morning, we were ushered into a large sitting room. There were about 30 of us sitting quietly in the circle, the men on one side, the women on the other. Baba appeared with his literally electrifying aura and slowly circled the group, smiling and looking at each of us playfully. Then he asked Dr. Gokak to interpret for him and sat down with us to discourse and answer questions. He spoke for about an hour on the meaning and value of turning our lives Godward to the reality of the higher self. He said, quote, "The purpose of your lives is to purify yourselves." End quote. He seemed to answer everybody's questions without anyone saying a word. His beauty was beyond description. He had some attendants bring out refreshments, and after we snacked, told us he couldn't see us any more that day, but would see us again soon. Everybody else left, but I was so filled with excitement that I stayed on, not willing to leave unless I was thrown out. Unfortunately, there are so many people yearning for Sai Baba that some take advantage of his hospitality, just as I was doing. I wouldn't think of imposing myself on him in such a manner now, but at that time I was still going through too many psychological changes in my relationship with him to be really clear about the distinctions between courtesy and devotion. As no one ushered me out, I decided I would stay there for eternity. I could gaze into the house and see Baba moving about, speaking to people, reading his letters, and carrying on with other activities. I thought this trip was going to be really great. I was going to bed down in the front vestibule and never leave. Then Baba went upstairs for a rest, and I lay down on the hard floor to await his reappearance. I was dozing when suddenly there was a flurry of activity. A car pulled up in front of the door. Baba appeared with a few people and jumped in. Baskets of food were thrust into the car, and off he went. As quickly as that, my dream of being close to him vanished. I was out in the hot sun again with only a banana for company. How could he do something like this to me? Only a few of those closest to him had known he was off for Puttaparthi. I found out later that he had sent Indra Devi to Bombay to present a short address in his absence to some 200,000 disappointed people awaiting his annual appearance there. What a load to fall on her shoulders. She was counting on Baba's help from afar to ease their disappointment. As for me, I decided to follow Baba. Early the next morning, a friend and I were in a cab. The day had begun cool and clear. A short distance from town, the hectic pace of the Bangalore streets gave way to the leisurely awakening of the countryside. The road was paved one lane each way. For long stretches, there was no one in sight. My mind quieted, drifting off toward the distant foothills and large expanses of space. We passed occasional bullock-pulled carts, the big, cumbersome animals lethargically urged onward by a driver who, like his animals, appeared lost in a dreamlike state. Approaching villages were signaled by the appearance of men tending their goats, and women, wrapped in worn, earth-colored saris, carrying objects on their heads. In the towns, I chuckled at the ingenuity of small Indian boys contorting themselves to ride bicycles much larger than they. The seat was usually too high, and the crossbar between it and the handlebars did not allow them to center themselves, so they had to ride hunched to one side like spiders. The feat was apparently not as difficult as it looked, for there were many of these little fellows on the road. Most of the villages were completely agricultural, and their pace of life was in almost cinematic slow motion in the merciless Indian heat. Simply taking a step was a task. A little over halfway, we passed a good-sized community set back behind a large stone wall. We were informed that this had been the grounds of royalty some 800 years ago, and the town was still flourishing. It was oppressively hot at Puttaparthi. Almost no one was out in the sun. After finding a place to stay in one of the dormitories of Prashanti Nilayam and eating a few mangoes, we placed ourselves by the temple to await Baba's appearance for darshan. The ashram had grown considerably since I was there last. With so few people about this time, the grounds are cleaner and quieter. There was the same holy atmosphere, a serene silence, and the sun appeared to bake everything white and pure. There was the same air of excitement, too, as the devotees gathered for darshan. The bhajans still had their special ring of devotion. We were happy to hear that the following morning Baba was going to preside at a nearby groundbreaking ceremony for a school that would be named for his mother. We would be able to see more of him then. How unpredictable Baba's activities are. The next day, a few others and myself walked to the area of the groundbreaking to find almost no one present. By the time Baba presented himself, there were no more than 20 or 30 people and a few mangy dogs to greet him. I couldn't understand why he had chosen to appear here while 200,000 people were awaiting his presence in Bombay. I just accepted the situation and enjoyed it thoroughly. Strolling up gracefully but forcefully, Baba presented himself in a flaming orange robe, darker in color than I had seen before. Holding a coconut in each hand, he skillfully broke them by striking one against the other and sprinkled the milk over the ground, then materialized some vibhuti, which he scattered over the milk. He was full of goodwill. After the coconut ceremony, he reached for a satchel filled with little packets of cookies and began to move through the crowd, giving them out. It is surprising how uncanny Baba is during his lovely gesture of distributing sweets. He misses no one. Being caught up in the midst of this small crowd was a joyfully humorous experience. The small children jumping up and down, their smiling faces, the dancing of their eager, outstretched fingers, and throughout, the image of 200,000 people sitting in a stadium in Bombay. All the pushing and pulling, the laughing and excitement of this youthful band momentarily transported me back to childhood. The highlight of the event took place when Baba approached close to give me some cookies and in the commotion stepped on my toe. I felt joy from the tip of that toe to the top of my head. The next day, Baba arrived back in Vrindavan, invited us in for a large bhajan meeting. He would lead devotional songs for us, and we would sing to him in return. Indra Devi volunteered that many of the Americans knew bhajans. I knew only one myself, and hoped fervently that Baba would ask me to sing it before someone else beat me to it. Baba seemed pleased by the occasion. He pointed to a young woman sitting across from me and asked her to sing. My heart dropped. She was singing the only one I knew. We all joined in and sang to Baba, clapping to the rhythm, filled with an excitement generated by deep devotion. I decided to keep quiet, sort of melt into the wall and go unnoticed. Then, to my great discomfort, Indra Devi, her face beaming, said, "Oh, Dr. Sandweiss has bhajans in his home weekly, and he sings them." My goose was cooked. Baba turned to me. "Go on," he said. I hemmed and hawed, cleared my throat, and finally said, "Baba, the only bhajan I know is Ganesha Sharanam, and that has already been sung." There was no reply, so I decided to sing my one and only bhajan. Perhaps if I sang with a great deal of enthusiasm, the duplication would be acceptable. But after the first two words, Baba gestured and exclaimed, "No, no, already been sung." And I fell back defeated and destroyed. It took me 2 or 3 days to get over the hurt. I resolved to learn more bhajans. Baba considers singing these devotional songs very important. They are supposed to have great effect on our meditation and spiritual outlook, and are performed by one person singing a verse and the rest of the group repeating it. All the words in a bhajan are the Sanskrit names of God as he has appeared in various forms and aspects. They supposedly hold within their sound vibrations capable of opening spiritual centers in those who hear them. Many of the words are used as mantras. The following is a quotation from Satya Sai Baba entitled On Bhajans. Some people may laugh at all this bhajan and call it a mere show and exhibition and recommend instead quiet meditation in the silent recess of the shrine room. But coming out in company and doing bhajan like this helps in removing egoism. One is not then afraid of being mocked at or ashamed to call out the name of the Lord. One gets inspired also by the devotion of others, the company of men with kindred sentiments helps to foster the tiny seedling of devotion and to keep it from being scorched by the heat of derision. For example, a person will sweep the floor of his room with a broom when nobody is looking on, but to do the same act when people are looking requires some mastery over the ego. In fact, Nama Sankirtana, singing bhajans in a group, will wean you away from distracting thoughts, whereas those thoughts will invade you when you do it alone. So sing aloud the glory of God and charge the atmosphere with divine adoration. The name of God is the most effective tonic to keep off all illness. So do not take shelter behind excuses, but attend all bhajan sessions. If you are ill, bhajan will help the cure. Or let me tell you, it is far better to die during bhajan with the Lord's name on the lips than at other times. Do not also indulge in Namasan Kirtana as a pastime or a fashion or a passing phase or as an unpleasant part of an imposed timetable to be fulfilled each day. Think of it as a part of spiritual training to be seriously taken for reducing the attachments to fleeting objects and purifying and strengthening you, liberating you from the cycle of birth and death and consequent misery. It may appear a frail cure for such a dreadful malady. Nevertheless, it is a panacea. The common excuse for escaping from this urgent duty to oneself is that there is no time for bhajan in the hectic schedule of activity that has become the lot of man at the present time. If the burden of 100-odd jobs can be borne because they are unavoidable, can the extra job of Nama Sankirtana be such an undesirable addition? He who carries 100 can surely carry one more. Have the bhajans on as many days as possible, or at least once a week. They can best be held either on Thursday or Sunday evening. However, this need not be strictly adhered to, since it is not the day of the week that counts, but the heart. Have them in a central place where all can come and join, and not in the houses of some people where all may not be welcome. Have them as simple as you can, and without the competitive pomp or show. Reduce the expenses to a minimum, for God cares for the inner yearning and not the outer trappings. No amount should be collected by passing the plate around or a subscription or donation list. God is omnipresent. He is the indweller of every heart, and all names are His. So you can call Him by any name that gives you joy. You must not cavil at other names and forms, nor become fanatics blind to their glory. When you sing bhajan songs, dwell on the meaning of the songs and the message of each name and form of God, and roll on your tongue its sweetness. Rama, this name must evoke in you the Dharma of righteousness, he embodied and demonstrated. Radha, this name must evoke in you the supermental, superworldly love she had as the greatest gopi, women who tended the cows, great devotees of Lord Krishna. Krishna, this name must evoke in you the sweet and sustaining love with which he drew all towards him. Shiva, the name must evoke in you the supreme sacrifice of the drinking of the deadly poison for the good of all the world, the cool grace heightened by the cascade of Ganga, the holy river, and the moonlight from the crescent. Remember, every song sung in praise of the Lord is a sword that cuts the knots of laziness. It is a fine piece of social service to remind all of their duty to the Almighty who watches over them. Keep the name of the Lord always on your lips, and you will find that all thoughts of envy and hatred will disappear from your hearts. If only you evince some genuine interest in your own real uplift, I am ready to stand by you and crown your efforts with success. Hence, do not waste time purposelessly. Let every moment be a bhajan. Avoid all lesser talk. Know the purpose of bhajan and devote yourself wholeheartedly to it. Derive maximum benefit from the years allotted to you. End of quotation. After the singing, everyone was beginning to leave when Baba pulled aside one of the volunteers who had worked with him for many years. A gathering of young Indian boys quickly surrounded them. We all pressed closer, and then the characteristic circular motion of his arm drew our eyes as if they were being pulled into the invisible vortex he was apparently creating in the air. Something silver suddenly flashed in his hand. It was a beautiful watch. The man who received the gift was humbled and overwhelmed as he took it into his hands. That evening, we were invited in for bhajans again. There was an American singing group there called Light Storm, which has made a record of American bhajans. They played their guitars, drums, and other instruments, and took turns singing with the Indian men. Baba began the session in the most beautiful, clear, and exciting voice imaginable, setting the tone for a very spiritual evening. The experience was a concrete demonstration of how love and the joyful singing of God's name unite people of such diverse backgrounds. As we experience together the yearning for God, the yearning to love and merge with God's grandeur, we all became the closest of kin. Baba gives a great deal of attention to the students at his school. They are always allowed around him, and the joyful admiration on their youthful faces is a vivid expression of the contact they experience with him. There were 20 or 30 young students sitting at his feet this evening. Their sense of ease and familiarity with the most complex bhajans, their special tonality and use of voice, precise pronunciation, and deep devotional attitude reflected clearly their heritage in this magnificent land of spirituality. In contrast were the guitar, bongo drums, and suggestion of a rock beat of the Westerners, who sang only the simplest type of bhajans. Still, it was obvious that the Indians understood our yearnings, and we understood theirs. We were the same at heart. Love, respect, and a deep feeling of kinship, regardless of ethnic background, nationality, or religion, awaken under such conditions. I was filled with the warmest glow and found myself thanking Baba for allowing me to see how we are all made brothers when in contact with the Father. There is no doubt that this reaction could happen among all people all over the world if they could somehow be awakened to the reality of the fatherhood of God. One of the aspects of Baba that I find most important is his Shiva, or destroyer, aspect. In the Hindu religion, the three major aspects of God as creator, preserver, and destroyer are represented by Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva respectively. When I first began learning about Hinduism, I wondered why one should worship the destroyer aspect of God, but as my relationship with Baba deepened, I began to recognize its significance. I have mentioned before that no matter how much I prepare myself as I draw closer to Baba, I begin to feel destroyed. This always comes about as a result of being too attached to the mind, with its almost infinite capacity to doubt, and the emotions, which easily lead me into turmoil. If he ignores me, I hurt and sulk. When he admonishes me not to give in to momentary pleasures, I become angry with such simplistic advice. If he appears to make a mistake, I feel that this can't be the way of divinity. When he permits suffering, I doubt. When there is a clash between my feelings and thoughts and his words or actions, I feel it's like dying to give up reliance on my sense impressions and mental conceptualizations and surrender totally to his will. And though I vow not to desire or demand anything of Baba, desiring is always rekindled by my contact with him, frustrating me until I feel hurt and defeated. I understand this reaction to be that of my ego struggling against being deposed, the struggle of a small self, mind and emotions, as its dominance begins to be overcome. But understanding does not necessarily lead to controlling. On this trip, as on the others, I wanted the limiting small self to be destroyed so that I could begin to merge with the greater universal self. But it is so difficult to give up identifying with emotion and mind, that which I thought I was for so long, and place full reliance on the avatar, to believe that he represents the true reality, and that my senses, emotions, and mind see only an illusion. It is impossible to experience such a crucial and elemental struggle without ambivalence. There seemed no end to my ego. Yet, in his infinite love, Baba continued to chisel away at it. Baba says, quote, "You have been born with one purpose, to die. That is to say, to kill the I. If Brahma dies, you become Brahman, or rather to know that you are Brahman. All this literature, all this effort, all this teaching is just to hold a mirror before you so that you may see yourself." End quote. After I had been with Baba for a week, he began calling on those who would be leaving shortly to arrange for private interviews. Three other men and myself were ushered into a small room where we sat down on the carpeted floor with Baba and Dr. Gokak, the interpreter. Baba was smiling and rocking back and forth blissfully. He turned to the fellow next to me, Jeff, and said casually, quote, "I came to you twice in dreams," unquote. Now, as a psychiatrist, I have certainly never heard of a colleague talking this way to a patient. Psychiatrists deal with dreams all the time, but to say, "I've come to you twice in dreams," would be somewhat disconcerting for the average patient. Such comments now, however, only serve to enlarge my conception of Baba's supernormal powers. In this case, I witnessed an occurrence which, while related to the work I do, was so far beyond it that my faith was reaffirmed many times over. Baba began to describe and interpret one of Jeff's dreams, and it became quite evident to me that he had, in some way, fashioned the psychic experience of this man, had actually created dreams for him, and visited him in another dimension of reality. Everything that Baba said, Jeff confirmed. Here was the greatest psychiatrist I'd ever seen. An experience in the dream that Jeff couldn't understand had to do with Baba's cutting up a fish and distributing it to people present and giving some to Jeff, even though he is a vegetarian. Baba smiled and said, quote, "Selfish, selfish, destroying selfishness," end quote, using the fish, in other words, as a symbol for the small I, the small self, a quality of which is selfishness. He frequently makes such a play on words even in English. Baba went on to speak of a message behind the crucifix, the small self, the small I, symbolized by the vertical part of the cross, negated by the horizontal section, the Shiva aspect of God. Then I was in for a real ordeal. Baba teaches with words, but he invariably tempers the words in the heat of experience. Jeff said that he had received a mantra from Indra Devi and wanted to know the correct way of saying it. Baba agreed to help. I knew that in advising people to repeat the name of God, Baba frequently instructs them to use a japamala, a religious necklace with 108 beads, similar to a rosary. The object is to repeat the name with each bead. I said to myself, "Aha, I bet Baba is going to create a japamala for Jeff." As I watched him, he brought out from behind his back in his left hand what indeed appeared to be a japamala. He continued speaking to Jeff, and it seemed to me that nobody else was looking at his left hand, that I was the only one who noticed it. My mind began to work. Could it be that Baba is really just a cheap magician who hides objects behind his back all the time, so forgetful that he takes this necklace from behind his back now and plays with it in front of my nose? What a stupid thought. But even as my mind attempted to argue away its own doubt, I could feel my heart sinking. No, I would not let him trick me into thinking he is just a bad magician. He continued to talk to us, smiling blissfully, and I continued to watch his left hand carefully. Back it went behind his back, then out in front again, and I just knew he was going to give the Japamala to Jeff as if he had materialized it. Then all of a sudden, he made the familiar circular gesture with the right hand, and there appeared in it a beautiful Japamala, but quite different from the one in his left hand. The one I had seen in his left hand was gone. I was stupefied by this turn of events. My doubting was certainly not new. It raises its ugly head whenever I'm beginning to take pride in my faith, beginning to believe that it is solid and unshakable. A fog of confusion comes over me. I know that Baba is destroying me, and I feel almost helpless before this reaction. He continued to speak to the other three men, generally ignoring me. I didn't mind. I was still trying to recover from the Japamala incident. He was always in direct contact with us, he said, but in case we should wish to write, he would give us a calling card. Then we would have his address. He moved his hand in the air and matter-of-factly pulled out three calling cards, handing one to each of the other fellows without giving me so much as a look. What surprised me about this was that in a short interview 6 months earlier, he had given me a card exactly like the ones he had just produced. Was he showing me that he remembered this? That he knew me better than that? With all my doubting, I believed. He sees hundreds of people daily. He's just bombarded with people. The mere fact that he might have remembered such a trivial occurrence 6 months earlier seemed to me quite a feat in itself, to say nothing of the materialization of the cards and the casual manner in which he carried this all out. It certainly helped take my mind off the mysterious Japamala. After this kind of demonstration, I've learned to say to myself, Sam, don't fall for any of those tricks and don't be destroyed. Just expect nothing, want nothing, and demand nothing. I left the interview full of smiles rather than suspicions or hurt feelings, and Baba said we would be called back in another day or so for additional private interviews. In a few days, we were back, and I felt well prepared, able to withstand any of Baba's tricks. He's not going to do that again to me today, I muttered with firmness to myself. I will not be destroyed. As we sat down, he looked at me and said, quote, "Your mind is confused," end quote. I felt myself slipping, but quickly reassured myself, no, I will not be destroyed. His criticisms, his tricks, nothing will destroy me today. Baba continued to look at me smilingly. Monkey mind, he said in a gentle, mocking tone of voice. He went on to talk with the others, but after a while again addressed me, quote, "What is it you want, sir? You have been here before," end quote. Baba, I said plaintively, I would like to merge with you. Baba said, quote, "Well, first you are in the light, then the light is in you, and then you and the light are one," end quote. I was slipping again. It was too late to stop the reaction. I felt terrible pain, a terrible letdown. My fog of confusion now had a raw edge of doubt. This is my third trip, I thought. 25,000 miles each time. Three times I've clawed my way to the side of the Avatar and listened to what he tells me, cliches. I've heard him say this 100 times. This was my opportunity and now it's gone. Baba's words trailed off into the air. He turned to a fellow named Steve and put his arm around him, laughing and talking lovingly with him, showing him that he knew things about him that no person could know. And I began to get jealous. He noticed a rather cheap-looking chain and medallion hanging around Steve's neck. He said, "I'll give you a good one." End quote. Oh boy, here we go again. I began to pray that he wouldn't materialize anything for me. He hadn't made anything special for me yet, and I decided I wanted to keep it just that way. I wanted to make something good out of what I felt was neglect. If you're going to neglect me all the time, fine. That's great, I sulked to myself. But in that case, always neglect me so I have something special on the next guy. I began to nourish the thought that Baba's not having materialized a medal for me in the past was really a status symbol. Then he gently moved his hand in the air and created four beautiful little medallions and casually tossed one to each of us. Now I had nothing on anybody. Baba had refused me even this neglect. This Shiva aspect of Baba becomes painfully apparent to me as I draw closer and closer to him on a physical level. Baba is so beautiful. He is so playful. Even though on the surface he can appear to be putting you harshly to task, his is really the kindest, most loving destruction I've ever witnessed. He took each of the other men into another room for a short, private interview. Each returned beaming, overwhelmed, awe-stricken, completely transformed. Then he walked over to me and asked when I was leaving. "I shall see you later," he said. There I was, the only one without a private interview, with a medallion I hadn't wanted to be given, feeling that I would never get close to Baba on a physical level, but left with the hope that perhaps I would get to see him later. Within a few days, summer school was to start, the school Baba had developed to teach spirituality to college students, and the ashram was buzzing with preparations. I knew it would be difficult to see Baba under such conditions, but still, I had some hope. Seeing this develop in me made me shudder. I knew I might well be in for a great disappointment. Finally, the last day came. Students and lecturers were arriving from all parts of India. I'd been trying my best to think of ways of getting an interview. I waited and waited in the hot sun, tried to send Baba a note, and waited some more. The day started to cool off, clouds gathered, and I waited. I asked where Baba was. He was checking on last-minute details about the starting ceremony for the school. I waited. The clouds became larger and more menacing. Then it began to rain. I got soaked. I waited through the rain until it got cool and night fell. It became quite apparent that I had absolutely no chance for a private interview. Completely drenched, I rode back to Bangalore in the back of a rickety, modified three-wheeled motorcycle, chilled to the bone by the night breeze. It had taken me three trips to discover how futile and frustrating it was to try to develop a close interpersonal relationship with Baba. I would not come back to pester him and frustrate myself unless struck by a clear, unmistakable, and overwhelming sign to return. That was the quiet vow I made to myself on that cold, rickety night journey back to Bangalore. This chapter concludes with the following quotation from Satya Sai Baba. Be attached under all conditions to the source, substance, and sum of all power, the Lord, and then you can draw from that source all the power that you need. This attachment is called bhakti. For the bird in mid-ocean flying over the dark, deep blue waters, the only resting place is the mast of a ship that sails across. In the same way, the Lord is the only refuge for man who is swept by storms over a restless sea. However far the bird may fly, it knows where it can rest. That knowledge gives it confidence. It has the picture of that mast steady in its mind. Its form is fixed in the eye. The name of the Lord is the mast for you. Remember it ever. Associate it with the form and have that form fixed in your mind's eye. It is a lamp shedding light in the recesses of your heart. Have the name on your tongue, and it will drive away the inner darkness as well as the outer. Peace within, brotherliness without. That is the sign of a person engaged in Nama Japam, recitation of the name of God. End quotation.